Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, December 1st, the Is He Your President edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm actually physically in the New York studios today with June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
But we're missing your sister.
I know. It's true. Hopefully she's still listening.
She was so great.
She was awesome.
I'm grateful
to have her.
Okay. So I read this morning that Trump wants to prosecute people who burn the American flag. It's just like reading these stories, you wake up in the morning and you're like, which one it is today? And then he says that. And then the newspaper has to patiently explain there's a constitutional ruling. You know, they do that very straight, like kind of straight man explanation. Like, no, you can't wrong. You can't do that.
But isn't he? I mean, he's completely doing that on purpose, right? That news came out right before he announced his pick for Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs, right? It's the Steve Bannon genius that's saying, OK, this morning you're going to wake up and tweet about, or tonight you're going to tweet about flag burning, and that'll distract people from the Goldman pick.
Do you think that's true, that yeah. media conspiracy that he is, like, we're all just, like, idiots because we read the Twitter feed and it distracts us from the real news?
Or is, I don't know if it's even specifically that. It's just, like, his method is carpet bombing. Like, just start 100 fires so that people, the media, opposition, everybody is so busy putting out 100 fires that they can't pay attention to any one of them. It's just like, we just need to put out these fires.
But the flag burning thing was so random that it made me think it was like, okay, we sat down and talked about what would get people the angriest. And it was flag burning.
But so Bannon is the most interesting person then.
Yeah.
That's the person someone has to follow closely and write a book about. He's if this narrative is true, and he's the recipe, like he's pulling all the strings. He's the interesting one because there's no way Trump is that strategic.
Right. No. I agree with that.
Yeah.
OK, well, that has nothing to do with our show. But since I didn't get to talk to you guys last week, I needed to get some Trump out of my system. Our topics today. First, the Women's March on Washington planned for the day after inauguration. What is it about? And is that the way we should be protesting? Second is the future of identity politics, a big debate going on about that, which we will get into. And third, we are going to talk about a new book, 26 Seconds, a book by Alexander Zapruder, whose grandfather took the famous Zapruder film, the only recording of JFK's assassination. We talked to her today. And then, June, you want to tell us about our Slate Plus segment?
Yes. Today, we'll be asking, is nail polish sexist?
And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you should be. You can start your free two-week trial by visiting slate.com/xxplus. So friends, we're going to do a special call-in show. We're going to do this show later in the month, but we need you to call in and ask us questions. And the kind of questions we want are, is something in your life sexist or not? You're not sure about it, something one of your coworkers are doing, something someone in your family is doing. Maybe it's something that you're doing and you have a question about, and we are here to pass judgment on that situation. So give us a call and ask the question. The number to call is 929-266-8195. That's 929-266-8195. Leave us your name and question. We'll ask it on the air. We will play your question on the air, and then we will respond to it. So please leave us your questions. We would love to hear from you.
I wish that phone number spelled something cool, like 1-800-PATRIARCHY, or like, you know.
Well, 1-800-NASTY-WOMAN.
And if you can make a word out of the letters in 929-266-8195, please let us know.
Yeah, we'll give you a free what?
Pen, notebook.
Free pass on sexism. I don't know.
Yes. Okay. So let's start with the Women's March on Washington. It started on Facebook, had thousands of people signed up before it had a permit, but it's still unclear what its message is. Is it a protest against Trump's misogyny, a positive message of hope, as some of the organizers have said, a demand to protect reproductive rights? But it is clear that women are excited about it. So we're going to talk about what the march should be. And then in general, if you're outraged, what is the most productive and useful response? Let's maybe start with the basics. So it was a woman in Hawaii, as I understand, who put up a post on Facebook and just invited her friends, right? This got started in like a classic social media underground way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just like one woman just making something happen among her own
her
social
group. Her
nickname
is Maui,
that's
apparently.
Right. Yes.
That's a good nickname.
And then it sort of...
Snowballed. Is that appropriate for something that starts in Hawaii? I'm not sure.
It snowballed all the way to New York, where an organizer...
It tsunamied
to New York, where an organizer named Bob Bland, a woman named Bob Bland, which I just gets me every time. Love it. Love Bob.
And the Bland.
The whole thing. Well, which is especially funny, ironic, because one of the fights that's emerged after Bob Bland took control was that it was white women who were in charge of this thing that ought to be led by women of color because they are more sort of threatened by the Trump administration, which makes the name Bland, I don't know, just a little bit funny.
Middle name White. Poor Bob White.
Poor
Bland.
Bob. Poor Bob. Sorry. And that is where it got sort of interesting to me, the sort of feminist infighting about who the organizers were and is it. And so then three women of color who are much more established organizers got involved and are helping actually, it seems like, get permits and corral this thing. But it did end up becoming that endless thing that happens in feminism where it's a little bit of infighting and, you know, pointing fingers like you aren't intersectional enough, which... I don't know. Does that take the wind out of the sails or does that just make it better?
I think it's better. I mean, and I also would say that that happens in every single group, you know? Mm-hmm. It's within each group there will be fights. And I do think that it is important to, you know, if right at the beginning of something, it feels like a positive thing that they were able to sort of say, hey, you know what? It's probably not a good thing if all of the organizers of this march are white. And
not professional organizers.
Yeah. And with very little experience, maybe even more to the point. I'm not sure. So, it feels like, I mean, it's challenging and awkward and all those adjectives, or are those adjectives? I'm not sure. But it does seem like it will make for a better march. What do you think, Hannah?
I think they just need to get over that quickly. Like, whenever I see that stuff, I think, like, oh, that's my group house that I lived in college. It's just like that when that kind of infighting becomes, like, the focus and the news, it's bad for the organization. It's bad for the feeling. It's bad for the spirit. It's just like, it's good, have it, move on, you know? So I was kind of monitoring the news in the hopes that that fight would last like 2 days max, and they would just get some new people to organize and just like move on quickly. Because there's no need to like alienate Maui and all her friends. And just like bring on some new people, you know, get the permits or don't get the permits, decide what you want to be, and then move on.
But that sort of happened, right?
Yeah. I was watching for it, but it happened. It didn't become this like big fight on all the feminist blogs about like you're appropriated the name, because that went on for a while. It was like you're taking the name of a march in Philadelphia that was for black women and you're doing that. But then it left. It passed. So I feel like they're over it, you know. So now the question is, what is it about? Like, you totally get different messages, which, again, always happens in these kind of protests. And that's OK. Although with the Occupy movement, that actually did become a problem, that nobody could totally understand what Occupy was about. And ultimately, that did rob it of some of its power. And we'll get to this when we talk about identity politics, whether the lack of a unified message is something that is eating away at the left. So and it is actually becoming a problem. But the march, it's like, you know, the question that I'm trying to figure out, it's the day after Inauguration Day. Like, can you protest the kind of what's a productive, good way to face the Trump administration when you feel how you feel? Is just like showing up good? I think maybe it's good. Like, I'm going to read what this woman, hold on, Brianna Butler, is that her name? Brianne, maybe Butler. "We're doing it his first day in office because we're making a statement. The marginalized groups you attacked during your campaign, we are here and we are watching. And welcome to the White House." Like, I kind of like that. Like, it's just like we have our eyes on you. I like this idea that people have put out there that you don't want to normalize the way he is and the way he talks. So just like a constant simmering protest is good, because otherwise it just like it just becomes part of the political and idiomatic norm. But I don't like that he's not my president business.
Right.
Like, I just don't like that. And I can't figure out why. Like, it seems slightly wrong to do it on the day after Inauguration Day, even though there isn't any other good day. But that general, like, upend the Democratic, like, he did win.
Right.
You know,
because you want a movement grounded in reality. Right. That's why it bothers you, probably. That's what I want. Like, well, he is our president and or president elect. And let's figure out how to protest within that structure.
But it also seems kind of bubbly again. Like, that's exactly what people said about Obama. Like, he's not my president. He's not even an American. He's a Muslim. He shouldn't be president. It's like, just doing that same thing doesn't actually seem useful or productive. And it also seems like, you know, you all saw the SNL skit. Like, it's like Brooklyn with the bubble on it, like the bubble skit, which is so funny. But that's like, I'm trying kind of like, I resist all that. This like, blah, 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 blah. Like, this didn't happen. It's not real. Yeah. You know,
I think that this march isn't about being productive personally. I think that this march, and I hope that things turn into, you know, more focused versions of protests. But I think this march is about anger and catharsis for people. And that a lot of people are trying to sort of retrofit intellectual frameworks on it, like, oh, this is about reproductive rights. This is actually about, you know, the rights of immigrants and Muslims because they are the most at risk. No, I think this march is just about women being really, really angry and seeking solace in community. And that's not actually an instinct that that I have. Like, I've gotten a bunch of Facebook invites to this march, and the idea of taking a bus to Washington, D.C. on inauguration weekend, when the city is going to be filled with Trump supporters and protesters from all over the country, there's going to be nowhere to go to the bathroom. It's going to be really cold. And you're just going to be out there holding your sign. And to me, that's not how I'm getting over my anger. But other people, I think, are going to find a lot of solace and community in it. And I think that trying to overlay it with other things, that's like step two, and this is step one that needs to happen.
Yeah, I suspect that I am more pro-protest than you guys, even though I haven't been to one in years and won't go to this one either. But there was a time in my life when I spent a lot of time marching and holding signs, and you know, I knew some really good chants. And it's
like what?
I know a lot of really good ones in Spanish, but so when you're in that, like, even if, you know, all of these marches tend to have these vague titles. Like, I remember one, March for Peace, Jobs and Justice. Like,
Hell yeah, I'm on board.
Basically, like, march for things that nobody's against, you know? And so, like, it's always a little bit of, let's just find a reason. Sometimes it's to show that, you know, say with, like, a big march, I don't remember what year, in D.C. for LGBTQ rights, you know, the fact that we got a lot of people there, it was like making a statement, look, there are a lot of us. I think that it's pretty obvious that there are a lot of, you know, non-Trump supporters, you know, say about 40 million of them, you know, maybe a couple of million more than Trump supporters. But it's still useful to go, if you want to, if you get charged up by being with like-minded people, by having a chant, by hanging out with your friends, by, you know, just getting riled up by it, that's great. It won't change the world. You know, marches generally don't, unless you have someone like Dr. King who's going to make an amazing speech. They generally are just a gathering and this show of numbers, but they generally don't accomplish anything or go down in history books.
They force people to consider an issue, right? Yeah. Like, there is no way that we would be talking about police violence against Black people in the same way if it weren't for Black Lives Matter. The Vietnam War protests, I think, made it through. I mean, Occupy. Poor Occupy.
I know. I guess there's a difference between ones where that are, you know, what do we say? That are started by, like, a very clear act of injustice, somebody being killed by the cops, for example, and one that's just sort of like, yes, there's a specific cause, the election of Donald J. Trump, but it's also, you know, a gathering. It's not an immediate, like, oh my God, we have got to stand up against this one thing that just happened.
It's interesting. The organizers, Noreen, I'm sorry, I just keep focusing. There was like a skit on Two Dope Queens, and I can't remember who it was, about someone going to a Black Lives Matter thing. And he was like, I'm cold. I can't go. I need a bathroom. I'm going home. It was like, okay, on the one hand, it's like Black Lives Matter, misogyny, reproductive rights. On the other side, it's like, I'm cold.
Right. I'm weak. I fully admit I am a weak sheep and I can't handle protest marches.
But it's funny. I actually, the way you guys are framing it makes me way more into it. But I feel like, let them just bring the rage. Like, they keep saying this isn't against Trump.
Right.
We're not about Trump. We're just, it's just like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Just like,
of course
bring
you
the
are.
Of course exactly. you are. Like, exactly. Bring the rage. You asshole. Like, we're just telling you that we have not forgotten all the shit that you did. Just because you won, we're here.
Right.
I'm also kind of, instead of this is not my president, a friend suggested, like, we all hang up American flags in D.C., and I was kind of into that. It's more like, this is my country too, instinct than you are not. Like, you are my president, but this is also my country. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of these things belong to me too.
Yeah.
Seemed reasonable.
Yeah. I think that's good. So you're not going to go. You're in D.C., but you're going to.
Well, it's so funny. I biked past the rafters that they were building yesterday.
Oh, for the inauguration?
Yeah,
already?
They're like building all this stuff, and it's the first time. It became real to me.
Huh.
I know that doesn't make any sense, but like, I wasn't on the show last week. I didn't talk to you. I was kind of in a bubble. And so it's just like, wow, there are people asking to stay at
I was gonna
our
say,
house.
Exactly,
like, that's
yeah.
a thing.
Right,
like, all my friends
right,
have people
right.
saying, I'm coming from LA. I'm coming from New York. Can you put us up? Can you put us up? So I know that this is coming. Yeah. I just I don't think, like you, I even have an excuse. Like, you can be like, I won't get on the bus. But I think I got to go. I'm curious. Like, I want to go see.
I think you should see.
There was that quiet vigil. I was actually out of town. I was in New York, but my whole family went to that silent vigil, and they were totally disappointed by it because it was silent. So I actually called them. I was like, oh, send me a movie of you guys there. And they're like, we can't because it's silent. We're not doing anything. It's so boring. And then came by this really loud protest. They were like, we're going to go with those guys. So this like ambivalence around being rageful is interesting.
Yeah.
So part of my anti-protest feeling is just baked into me. Like, in high school, my mom offered to take me out of school to protest the Iraq war. And I was like, I got a Latin exam. I gotta say. But I also think that I feel very lucky to be a journalist. And that is my instinct in moments like this.
Yeah.
Like, I just feel like I know a lot of journalists who have been talking about going to protests and have gone to protests. And to me, that's sort of how I came around to thinking about it as a catharsis thing. Because in terms of what you can actually do, if you are a journalist, you're sort of in a lucky position where theoretically the work that you do could make a difference in this. But for people who are not journalists and maybe share my anti-protest, just like kind of attitude towards protests. Like, what should they be doing? I'm looking at June because June has a long radical revolutionary organizer past.
Yeah, I've already forgotten all of my. I mean, so we had a Outward, that is, did a piece. It was a very sort of slightly random piece that were we just called out people and said, "What are you feeling right now? What are you feeling about Trump? And are you afraid? And what is it that you're afraid of? And what are you doing to kind of confront those fears?" And people were afraid, and they were mostly afraid of Mike Pence, who has a terrible record on so many things and actually has ideology in a way that Trump really doesn't.
And is our real president, like the one actually reading the intelligence briefings.
Surely. And so, you know, yes, they were afraid, but the things that they said they were doing were like, just hold him accountable, you know, write letters, you know, do letter writing campaigns, protest if you want to, but like, do whatever you think will make a difference and that you can do, you know. Getting on a plane from LA and going to DC, I'm not sure. Like, if you really want to, yes, do it. But I'm not sure that's, like, is that the most effective thing for a person in LA who's really mad to do?
Well, this is exactly what I'm trying to figure out. Because, Noreen, I'm like you. I have an instinctive, like when the crowd goes this way, I don't want to go that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's stupid. That's just a stupid instinct.
Right.
Like, it's not, it's equally unintelligent to just be like reflexively anti what everybody else is doing. And so what, as a journalist, there's lots of stuff that you can do. And holding accountable is a main thing, because if you've got a Republican Senate, Congress, you know, if you've got Steve Bannon like holding trinkets in front of us, like, you have to be smart and like keep your cool. But if you're a person, like if you're just a person.
Unlike a journalist.
If you're a human being with emotions and a heart, then what do you do? Don't you just pick your issue and pick your issue and give it money? Or like, you pick a specific issue, like give money to legal aid for immigrants. Like pick the one that, pick an actual thing that you think is, you know, he's going to do something.
Or get involved in state level politics or local politics, all that stuff, sort of. Do what the Republican assuming.
Or care a lot about the midterm elections, you know, which nobody does. Like, it's boring, but do that. Like,
Democrats, go out and vote in the midterms.
Yeah, exactly.
I bet they will. I bet that will happen big time.
I hope so.
All right, let's move on to our next topic, the future of identity politics, a very thorny and complicated topic. Mark Lilla, who's a political scientist at Columbia, he laid down the gauntlet in an op-ed called The End of Identity Liberalism, which kind of framed this topic in the perfect way, largely because it pissed a lot of people off and got a lot of responses going. Mm-hmm. His basic idea was that American liberalism has been poisoned by identity politics. It wasn't polemical in that way, but it was more that it was a bad political strategy, that essentially what identity politics has done is fracture everyone into their pieces and thus rob from liberalism a coherent and winning message, like a kind of universal value that it stands for. Let me ask you guys this. Do you want to start by talking about his op-ed, or do you want to start a little more basic? Like, I think, like, one basic thing that I need clarified in my head is people, the right especially, talks about PC and identity politics interchangeably, and they are not the same thing. Right.
Yeah. Right. Which I think if Michelle Goldberg's piece on Slate made a smart distinction between those two things, and she sort of argued, okay, we can.
Say what the distinction is, just so it's in identity politics is this is a kind of place from which a political action starts. It's like my political values start with.
Like, I am from Queens and my parents are immigrants.
Right. This is my identity. Right. It's like an expressive place from which your values spring, whereas PC is like an external expectation culture. It's like a policing. It's something that comes from outside.
It's a little scolding.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot of bad associations in this moment in particular. And I just personally found that to be such a useful distinction to have in my head. Because I am kind of sick of the more bullying aspects of political correctness, to be honest. Let's go back to the Lilla piece, actually, because Lilla is really happy to just throw it all out, to just start over. And he cites Reagan and FDR as unifiers.
And Bill Clinton.
And Bill Clinton, yeah. He he just really seems delighted to not have to worry about the interests of women, people of color, gay people. There's like a little too much eagerness. And he also just says some boneheaded things. Like he says that, you know, he hates reading about, or he's sick of reading about things like transgender rights in Egypt, because what do those tell you about the larger sort of moral and political and economic currents? I mean, that tells you a lot.
Right? Right,
exactly. It's just like it's like deliberately misreading. And that's not to say, and I think that the way that this was written was designed to piss people off, like mm-hmm. you said.
It's provocative.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of white male liberal academics, at least ones that I know, feel exactly this way. They cannot believe that they are the bad guys. Like, it is infuriating to them. They are serious progressives. Like, they're humanities professors on campuses who have conceived of themselves deeply as part of the left and as very progressive. And they are just like, I cannot believe I'm the enemy. Like, mm-hmm. everybody on their campus, and it's very personal for them. Mm-hmm, it's not mm-hmm. even like people in other professionals, because this is a campus thing. And so their students are looking at them.
And denouncing them.
They are the bad guy. Right, like, they're right. the enemies. And right. I think that's what I felt like a lot of the passion was like, this is very personal
but
for
that,
him.
But that goes back to the PC thing. I think mm-hmm. that's what a lot of those people are reacting to. Mm-hmm. And that has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And so then the more interesting level of this argument is that the current PC culture actually drove a lot of people into the arms of Trump and this white nationalist.
Yeah, so it's a bad political strategy.
Yes.
It's just like, at one level, it's the cultural argument. At another level, his more convincing argument, or at least the one to engage, is the one, is this a bad political? This is like the Nancy Pelosi argument. Like, did this lose the election? Like, there are a couple of his sentences which made me pause, which I thought were good. Like, identity politics is largely expressive, not persuasive, which mm-hmm. is why it can lose elections but not win them. That's an interesting idea. Like, mm-hmm. it's about your personal expression. It's in and of its face kind of siloed, so it's not a bigger – I'm not saying
but,
I agree with
right.
this, but that's an interesting
thing. He's patently
thing.
Wrong. Trump just won the election
yes.
on the strength of identity
yes.
politics.
Right. Yes.
They just happen to be
– white male.
White
identity
male
–
or yeah. white Christian, you know, sort of framework identity politics. But he
– that is my problem with this whole yeah. argument. The left did not originate – identity politics. I know this because I grew up in Queens, in working class Queens, where everybody voted for Trump, and they're just like, identity politics to the core. It expresses itself as tribalism. It doesn't right. have the same language, but mm-hmm. the left did not like come up with this idea that like I'm in my silo. And I feel like the reason that the white men who now call themselves the white men, George Packer had a really interesting article in New Yorker, which was like the left gave the white evangelicals or the white men, you know, the fact that we call them the white working class, like it uh-huh. gave them identity politics. They were ready to receive it. You know, they live in a tribal world, even if they have no, like, they live in a totally homogenous neighborhoods and they mm-hmm. don't live in mixed race neighborhoods. I feel like they took that mantle on
well,
pretty quickly.
There's a thing where I mean, and I know that privilege is one of these words that, you know, starts fires and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But, you know, white people don't think that they're white. They think that other people are not white. You know,
right.
like there's a lot of cisgender people who hate the name cisgender because it's like, I'm normal. Well, yes, you're the majority, but like you mm-hmm. just because only a few people are transgender, you're still cisgender. You're still a thing.
Well, you're a thing. Right.
You know, so there's a lot of like rejection of wait, don't give me a name. I'm normal. And I think that's what a lot of white people in America go through. And I think the whole thing with the Lilla point of view, which is like, you hush down for now, you know, and you stay quiet, let's not deal with this. It's like, well, when is it time to confront injustice? You know, the time for justice is always now. It's always time. Like, if something is screwed up, if someone's being screwed over, what, you want me to just stay quiet about it until, like, you over there, maybe probably you white guys, think it's time to talk about it? No.
Liz Merriweather wrote a very funny piece for us where she imagined going into a deep coma as a woman and being only allowed out of it when or like maybe going into a spaceship or something ridiculous. Yeah. But like, I'll wake up when the white liberal men tell me it's okay wake up. And right. I'm taking all the black people with me and we're all just going to go to sleep until they say it's okay. It was sort of absurdist.
But that doesn't engage the argument as like if it lost you the election. I don't know that. I'm just saying the argument is not, you know, should you not do it? It's should you think about the consequences of it and whether it has alienated America. Like this is the debate around Nancy Pelosi. That's the question. Now, I don't know.
But the consequences for whom? The consequences for because, yes, if white people are upset by Black Lives Matter, if straight people are upset by queer rights, and they're going to say, all right, I'm not voting with those people. Like, I don't want to be with those people anyway. I don't want Trump to be president, but
this might be a too rosy view of it, but I think there's a certain percentage of people who it's not that they're upset by Black Lives Matter or gay rights. They're upset by the way it is being it very quickly turned to it's not just that you're in favor of it. You have to be in favor of it. And you also have to speak about it in this certain language. Right. And if you don't say it in this language, then you're not really in favor of it. And I can't take the time to educate you and all this kind of stuff that really turns people off. Mm-hmm. And you know, values have shifted very rapidly. And a lot of us were very happy about that and sort of patting ourselves on the back. But for someone who, you know, might be of an older generation and might totally support gay and transgender rights, but the word cisgender doesn't trip off their tongue super easily. Mm-hmm. And then to be sort of policed around that, that's how you alienate someone. And I just want to read, this was from Michelle Goldberg's piece, which I really liked and recommend to all of you. She quoted Ellen Willis on sort of the last version of this backlash. She wrote, this was in 1992 in an essay called Identity Crisis. Coercion and guilt mongering, the symbiotic weapons of authoritarian culture, inevitably provoke resistance. When the left uses these tactics, it merely encourages people to confuse their most oppressive impulses with their need to be themselves, offensively honest instead of hypocritically nice. Perversely, racism and sexism become badges of freedom rather than stigmata of repression, while the roots of domination in people's rage and misery remain untouched. And that just seems like exactly what's
happening. So transliterate that. So what that means is what? That means that
if you tell me I can't, you know, talk about Black Lives Matter in sort of a non-holy terms, let's say, like H-O-L-Y, then I'm just gonna rebel against that, and not me.
Yes, one. And then it sounds like racism, but instead of seeing it as racism, people start to see it as like a kind of like
freedom.
Freedom. Like it's my freedom to talk in a certain way.
And then you move that, you wrap up the class issues with that. I mean,
so what's the way out of that? Like what's the way out of that? Is it just like a language change? Is it, you know?
Well, okay. So Jamal Bowie wrote what I thought was I'm just like quoting Slate writers right
quote
now.
But so Slate,
Jamal wrote it was a thoughtful piece about Jesse Jackson's approach to this in the 80s when he had sort of the prototypical Trump voter coming out to his rallies and actually putting paper bags over their face because they were like in a weird way embarrassed to be there. But that he was able to appeal to the white working class by talking about their identity and what, you know, the way that class was wrapped up in their identity and the way that, you know, their struggle was not the same as that of the, you know, an urban black worker, but it was related. And he talked about it being a patchwork quilt.
Right.
And it was
each group can't change things on their own. But if all the groups come together, I may form a rainbow coalition.
Well, Mark Lilla says that, like, if you're going to talk about the identities, you better talk about all the identities. You can't talk about one.
But he wants it to be pre-identity or post. He wants to basically erase the identities.
Yeah.
He may not say it, but ultimately the identity he wants is the one from, you know, it's a very nostalgic view. We're essentially white male.
He wants what's the 60s classic student organizing group?
The SDS.
SDS, which was like super sexist and all white men. He wants that view of the world, which Ross Douthat in...
I love that.
I love
piece.
That.
That
piece.
Was really, really interesting. Yeah. It was like people need meaning. Like this is the like if the left is kind of, you know, secular, post-religious, which campuses are the representation of the kind of imagine all the people together. They need
he calls it
some,
Leninism.
Leninism.
Like with an O. Like the Beatles. Yeah.
And so like you need something to root you and mm-hmm. give you meaning. And that is what identity right. politics is.
Right.
So it is not possible to throw it away. That is our value. Like you said, June, that's what you believe. That's what you stand for. So there, you can't just move to a different alternative because that's where your values are rooted. But you can find a way to make that. I'm not saying accommodate,
right.
but to not the policing element,
yeah.
right? Like a way to separate identity politics from the kind of righteous, the sort of righteousness of your wrong, not in an accommodationist way.
Right.
I just think that we have to remember that a lot of the time the policing comes from a place of pain. Like mm-hmm. people have been really hurt for a long time and they, it's a like, and so I agree,
true.
It's not productive. It's not, but. Okay. We have to understand where it's coming from.
I also think in our inbox where we get a lot of this mm-hmm, policing, mm-hmm. it's mostly from white ladies telling us that we are not respecting the rights, you know, that we are not. And so that is where it sort of starts to irritate me particularly. Sorry if I'm offending all of our listeners, but there's a lot of sort of borrowed angst. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, like this is for the good in our culture. Mostly it's pushing things forward. It comes from a good place. It has, I think, made me smarter and more conscious about these things. Mm-hmm. But it's not always from
not pleasant.
There's a lot of borrowed identity politics. And I think that can irk people, you know, like having a 22-year-old from, you know, Greenwich who went to Oberlin telling you about how no one at college had lived outside the privilege bubble, which actually like I've heard someone do. And it was just like, oh, you are not self-aware.
I think that quote you read was correct. Like it does, you know, if there are emotional realities which come from pain, there are also emotional realities that come from sort of repression and policing that have consequences. So it's just you be honest about mm-hmm. all of those realities and the consequences that they produce, which in this situation is no joke. Like it did get us in, you know, they did bring us
yeah.
this precedent. Like what, you know, Maureen Dowd quoted, Maureen Dowd had a great column where she republished an essay from her brother Frank, and it was all about PC stuff. Like you, this is what you deserve, right? If I talk to the Trump people who are all in my family and family's friends, it's all about the PC policing. Now, I don't know, you know, I don't know if beneath that is all racism or resentment, but maybe what we can do is separate the like make the truth of racism separate from the truth of kind of policing and language. I don't know. I'm not being that articulate. I'm trying to follow you down this road of like, is there a way to separate the kind of true and necessary gains of identity politics, the world turned upside down that June talks about that needs to happen, the pain and emotional realities and the repressive nature of it. Can those two things be separated? Is that the lesson?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think it's tough. I think people need to do real work on thinking about how to sell it better to people, because I really bristled at Lila's idea that you just sort of table it, you know.
Right. Right. Not possible. Right.
It was also, I mean, whatever. It was just an irritating essay on a lie. But mm-hmm. it presumed that this stuff is not tied up with the larger goals of the Democratic Party economically and in all kinds of ways. But
so it's a packaging problem. It's like if Trump managed to so well package his, you know, millionaire ass as a populist hero, then there's like a better packaging we can put on what is the left's true values.
I think it's also an education problem, frankly. I think one of the things that bugs me about sort of the campus left at this moment is it is illiberal in that sort of classic sense, and I feel like there is not a deep enough understanding of what liberalism means for a lot of these kids, and what are, you know, what justice means in the American sense, and all these processes that we have in place, and I just wish that there were more discussion about that or more evidence that people were listening to those ideas. That I think is what bugs me.
All right. Well, anybody who wants to give Noreen a job in your university so she can set the kids straight, bring it on. She's available. She's available for weekend teaching.
That's what we're calling it now.
All right. Our next topic, we are going to talk about a new book, 26 Seconds, a book by Alexandra Zapruder about the Zapruder film, the famous film of the Kennedy assassination, which was taken by her grandfather. The book is wonderful. It's part memoir, part history. And we have Alexandra with us today to talk to us. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi. So glad to be here.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on the book, for one thing.
Thank you.
Why don't we start pretty basic? Like, how is it that you're grandfather came to have this movie?
So my grandfather was a transplant to Dallas, Texas in the early 1940s. He had come from Russia in 1920 as a 15-year-old boy and had lived in New York for many decades working in the garment industry. And then they had an opportunity to go to Dallas, he and my grandmother and my dad and my aunt. So they relocated to Dallas. And in 1963, he had a business that was at 501 Elm Street, which is just adjacent to Dealey Plaza, where the very end of the motorcade was going to be. And so part of it was proximity, but part of it also was that he was this very avid home movie maker. You know, he'd been taking home movies since the mid-1930s, which is really pretty early.
That term home movie, that's the thing I remember, like, when I at first ever talked to you about this book, like, you use the term loosely home. Like, all we know is we've got these iconic images in our head. When ever anyone thinks Kennedy assassination, they immediately call up the moment from that movie. And yet you routinely refer to it as a home movie, which is slightly confusing, you know?
Right. Well, it was a home movie. I mean, it was, you know, in a lot of ways, it was like all the other, I mean, it didn't turn out to be like all the other home movies, but I mean, he sort of set out to do what he had been doing for decades, which was to film, you know, important moments in his life. And, you know, most of his home movies are just like everybody else's home movies. They're, you know, my aunt and my dad when they were children, or the grandchildren, or travels or whatever. But this was, you know, this sort of special opportunity. And in fact, you know, the other piece, though, that I have to say, and again, it does go to the whole home movie thing, is that he was this very, very devoted Kennedy fan. You know, he loved John F. Kennedy, and our whole family did. And so I think he wanted to be there with the idea that he was going to capture, you know, this great moment. And it was going to be sort of the, you know, the crown jewel in his otherwise, you know, pretty ordinary home movie collection. But I call it a home movie partly because that's what it is, and partly because I think people don't realize that, you know, he wasn't an ABC reporter. He wasn't a professional photographer. He wasn't in the press pool. He was just a completely ordinary citizen who happened to capture this moment. And the fact that it was a home movie just changed the whole course of that piece of film, was sort of determined by the fact that it was so personal.
Hey, Alex, I just struck me that you mentioned, I think, that, you know, There were two sides to these films that he recorded on, and that on the first side there were literally, you know, images of his family. He tested the camera by like taking some shots of his assistant. What I'm curious, you know, in the book you talk a lot about the exact, you know, what happened to the film in exact detail after the events of November 22nd, 1963. But what happened to the images that were just of your family and of his assistant? Were they also just like kept and made a million copies of and so on?
Well, no. I mean, for a long time, I'm not exactly sure, actually. It's a great question, and no one really seems to know when those images were separated from the images of the motorcade, but they were separated. Okay. I mean, probably not on the original film, but in terms of the duplicates that were made. And I think our family, you know, we always sort of assumed that, you know, those were our home movies. When the rights were sold, they weren't sold for that part of the film. And people were never really interested in that until much more recently. You know, now I think when you see the film with the whole strip before it, and you see, you know, you see it as a whole movie, it looks, it really looks completely different. I mean, you know, contextualized in that way, you can't forget just how very personal this was. So the original, I'm sure the original, you know, strip is still intact. The rights are, you know, there's some question about it. We donated the rights of the film to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, and they may technically have them, but I'm sure that they wouldn't use them without asking us.
And can you talk a little bit about what happened to the film of the motorcade itself in the immediate aftermath and then sort of through the years as the rights were debated?
Sure. Well, right after the assassination, my grandfather was distraught. He was on Dealey Plaza. He was screaming, "They've killed him." I mean, you know, he saw through the Zoom lens exactly what had happened. And so he was, you know, absolutely sure that the president was dead. And he was still on Dealey Plaza when he was approached by Harry McCormick, who was a Dallas Morning News reporter who had rushed over to cover the scene. And it was Harry McCormick who eventually went and got Forrest Sorrells, the head of the Secret Service in Dallas, to, you know, try to figure out how to get the film developed and get it into the hands of the federal authorities, which was my grandfather's main concern at that moment. And it's so interesting because the story of that day and how long it took them and how laborious it was to get this film processed is just, you know, I always think about, you know, just how far we've come and the instantaneous quality of, you know, all of filmmaking now. I mean, it took that. Normally these films would have been sent to Rochester to the Kodak Lab, but they opened up a line at the Kodak Lab at near Love Field in Dallas, you know, duplicate or process the film. Then they had to go to another place to duplicate it. Then they had to bring those duplicate rolls by hand back to the Kodak Lab to process them and then hand carry them to, you know, deliver two of them to the Secret Service. So it really was, you know, this incredibly long and complicated and involved thing. And a lot of the story of the film and the life of the film is about, you know, the technological limitations of the time and the way that that shaped how the film got out into the world and how that shaped what people thought of the Kennedy assassination.
The book is resonant with this political moment. I'm sure that's completely accidental, but just like the passion. I mean, that letter that your grandfather wrote to Kennedy is so beautiful. The kind of earnestness and like how you just described the film as an act of love. Like you really feel it in that letter. Like he takes so seriously this idea of like, what can I do for? Tell me what I can do for my country. It's like the sweetest letter ever. But did you guys have that sense that there's just some resonance in the kind of passion and the crowds, and there's just something felt so 2016 reading about it?
Totally. And also just in that way that you know, in the whatever we're calling it now, truthiness, you know, that people kind of people will reject sort of expertise and the views of panels of worthies and say, no, I don't see it that way. I'm rejecting that. That feels very of the moment, too.
I was also struck by the sort of feeding frenzy of the media, which felt pretty modern, too. And can you talk a little about the bidding war that happened and the way that sort of in some ways haunted your feelings about the tape down, you know, through the decades? The complicated
way. Think just to say before I describe that, that, you know, I'm sort of amazed, and I think it's going to take me some time, to be honest, to sort of figure out what the exact resonances are with this time, because this time is turning out to be so not what I expected it was going to be that, you know, it's very disorienting right now. But I think, you know, questions about the media and the role of the media and conspiracy, the nature of conspiracy thinking, post-truth, you know, the sort of idea that we're in a post-truth society, basically, you know, we can't, there's no consensus on facts, you know, all of these things, not to mention, you know, rhetoric and, you know, the sort of political climate in Dallas and all the ways in which that fed into everything that followed. All these things feel, you know, like you say, very much of the moment in some because they so contrast with the time and some because they're a weird kind of repetition of that time. And I feel like I'm, as the book is coming out into the world, I'm sort of thinking about this very thing, like like, how do I read the book I wrote through the lens of the present time that we're in, which is really a very, very, very peculiar experience, I have to say. I mean, in terms of the media, the, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, in some ways this is such a familiar thing that, you know, the media heard about the film. This was on the day after the assassination. And, you know, there was a, there wasn't really a bidding war, but there was a frenzy for, from different reporters who wanted to purchase it. Although I think my grandfather had, you know, pretty much made up his mind to sell it to Life magazine from the outset because of what Life magazine was and because of how Richard Stolle, the young reporter, conducted himself and the sense that it would be treated carefully there and with discretion, and which is another thing that is like so, you know, it's almost laughable today that that was even a consideration and that a giant, you know, Goliath like, you know, Life magazine would honor, would even like enter into to a conversation about like how
I disagree with that. I read some of that behavior and I was like, that's not cool. I, even now, like what Dan Rather did, like to abide by an agreement and then break the agreement. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that now in 2016.
No, you wouldn't do that. But what I mean is that Life did honor their agreement with my grandfather. They did, they, in spite of enormous pressure. And, you know, the idea that, you know, that a giant corporation like that would sort of that there could be a personal gentleman's agreement, you know, between two people about how this piece of film should be handled in the public is just, it's such a thing of the past in my mind. I mean, if you, you know, if you turn your stuff over to somebody, like you can't expect them to, you know, be worried about your feelings and that they certainly not about the feelings of, you know, a public figure or a public figure's family. I feel like we've gone, you know, completely to the other side of, you know, just the whole idea of decorum and discretion and, you know, what is or isn't appropriate to be seen. I mean, what's left, you know, like what's, is anybody protecting anything anymore? And that's, I'm not even necessarily saying it's a bad thing, but it's where we are. And for me, the story of my grandfather and the media is so much, everything in this story is so much about its time. You know, it reflects a time in a way that, you know, is hard to ignore. I mean, that's part of what I loved about writing the book was that, you know, there were so many things that happened that you think, wow, this is so 1963.
Right.
And it wouldn't have happened this way in 1973 or 83 or 93 or today.
Well, I will say that's one of the pleasures of reading the book is just diving into that moment and the particularities of that moment, the media, the political culture. So it's you know, it's beautiful to read for that reason and also for your own reflections of what it was like to live with the name and live with the reputation of it.
Thank you. You know, one thing I should just add, sorry.
Go ahead.
One of the things that I've really been struck by is, you know, when you put a book out there, there's a sort of sense of like, does it, are the big themes or the big ideas kind of coming across? And I've been really struck by how much people have wanted to talk about the personal side of this or how much emphasis there's been on, you know, sort of my assessment of what it was like to be a Zapruder. And if it weren't for the larger historical forces, if it weren't for the idea that the film had an enormous impact on American culture and American life in all kinds of different ways, I would never have written this book. You know, I would not have written a straight memoir. What sort of persuaded me to go so much against our family culture was the fact that, you know, the ramifications for this piece of film went so far outside of our family. And that, I think, is something that, you know, for me is sort of interesting to see, like, where that, you know, where that gets seen and understood and where it gets sort of passed over in favor of a more, you know, the sort of emphasis on memoir, which is so much of the time right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think both come across in the book pretty clearly.
thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on today to talk to us about it. It's 26 Seconds by Alexandra Zapruder. You should go and buy it. It's a wonderful and really interesting book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. It's so much fun to be together.
All right, let's move on to our recommendations and then our Slate Plus segment. Noreen, what do you have for us today?
So I have two things. I'll be quick. One is that over Thanksgiving, I was home with my family, and we were trying to find a movie that we could all agree on Netflix. And that movie for the Malone family is What About Bob, which we had on VHS in the 90s. And watched about a million and one times. And it really holds up. It's Bill Murray is so funny. And Richard Dreyfuss is like underrated as what he does. And I think speaking of sort of, you know, political correctness, that if that movie came out now, it would probably get there would be some criticism about its portrayal of the mentally ill. But once you get beyond that, it's really just so funny. And then the other thing is I want to endorse Matt Iglesias's Gilmore Girls tweets.
Oh, my.
So I have a long, tortured, mostly loving relationship with Gilmore Girls. I'm deeply competitive with Rory Gilmore, who is my exact age, my fictional rival. So I obviously watched it this past weekend and found out that a lot of things about Stars Hollow actually annoy me as an adult. But Matt Iglesias, who is sort of a policy
wonk
for Vox, mostly tweets about the news and economics, but he decided to start watching Gilmore Girls, the original one. And so his Twitter feed has been recently just sort of tweets about Trump, but interspersed with totally context-free tweeting about the show. And usually I hate people who tweet about TV because if you're not watching it, you sort of don't, you can't follow along and it's just whatever. But I just, because I'd watched the whole show, I got all these references. I found them funny. He also brought his wonky, you know, brain to it. So I just have the most recent one pulled up, but there are better ones. He said, you know, so they're half emotional. Lorelai should try being nice to her mother every once in a while. True. And then he followed it up. She also ought to think more creatively about how to structure the terms of a trust. So I really enjoyed it. So full endorsement.
That's
there.
Awesome.
Half endorsement for the reboot.
I feel like whoever's listened this far in the show, I want to know people's holiday movies, because there's a problem with family holiday movies. Like, ours is Love Actually, which is cisgender
worst.
Hell, right? It's like
worst.
Just bring
it's
on the hate.
It's just so anti-American.
Anti-American. It's just like wrong in every way, like race, gender, everything. And so like everything about it is wrong. And yet that's like the holiday. But I feel like, can people bring on their just like shameful holiday movies? All right, well, I'm going to bring the whole mood down with my recommendation. So my father died last week, which is why I wasn't on the show, which is so sad. So all I read is books about death. Like, the kids and the cousins came to visit this weekend. I was like, hey, guys, let's go to the Holocaust Museum. That's fun, because that's what we're doing, kids. And I actually made them all go to the Holocaust Museum.
Did you really?
Yes. Yes. They're like, let's go to a museum, Aunt Hannah. I was like, the Holocaust Museum. That's what I want to do. Anyway, so that's all I do. But I'm reading an amazing book. Death is so mysterious, and there's so much about it, like the whole process of it, that even though it happens to the best of us, is so sort of shocking and horrifying. And then I'm reading this book, Tinkers, which has been by my bedside for a long time by Paul Harding. And it begins with a deathbed scene. I know this is so fun for you all, but it begins with a deathbed scene. It's about a guy and his relationship with his father. And it's so resonant. Like, he begins in these hallucinations that he's having about the house, which are precisely the ones my dad has. And it's just such a beautiful book. He's a clock repairman. And that's another thing that happens. It's like the way the nature of time shifts and the kind of stories that my dad told in his last weeks were so different than the stories that he had told the rest of his life. And like, why did he choose these stories was something I wondered about. Like, what's the narrative that people are telling themselves in that moment? And the book just does so much for me in explaining that. So for listeners out there who are in this moment or have been in this moment or live in this moment for decades after, which, you know, happens to some people, you should read Tinkers. It's really amazing.
And can I add an additional recommendation related to this, which is Hannah wrote a really lovely piece about her dad a few years ago in New York Magazine's Reasons to Love New York City issue. Her dad was a cab driver. And you just, I don't know, it was such a loving portrait, and it's always stuck with me as one of the great essays we've run in that issue. So,
oh, that's so nice. I wish I had recorded him. I had never talked to him about his days as a taxi driver, and but I just interviewed him for this New York Magazine, but I didn't record it. He had so many good stories that he had never told me, like, oh, yeah, Jackie Kennedy was in my cab, and, like, it was like, what? Like, wouldn't you, like, when you came home that day, like, you didn't think that was, like, an interesting piece of information? And that she was, like, a really bad tipper. She gave him a 25
said tip. That was the best.
I seem to remember the last words of your New York Magazine piece were, tip really well.
Tip well, yeah. And never take Uber. That's my life philosophy.
All right.
June, what do you have?
Mine is a very different recommendation. I have recently, for reasons I can't possibly explain, after a complete lifetime of the opposite, taken up drawing.
Oh, cool. Oh.
And since I have no particular talent in that direction, I've been watching a lot of videos. Videos, as you might expect, are a really good way of not learning to draw, but just kind of picking up some tips. And so I've been spending a lot of time watching YouTube. And there's one particular guy who has a YouTube channel and who's a very prolific producer of videos with art tips or art supplies reviews and things like that. I really love him. And his name is Teo Yi Chie. He's from Singapore. And he does insanely awesome sketching, especially urban sketching videos. So if you ever want to get into sketching and drawing, that's a really good way. Like, you still have to do it, but watching his videos is a really good way of doing it. And he's really a fantastic host and teacher, really.
Can you spell that? I'm sending that to my mom immediately because she's like an amazing sketcher and I want to give, will love that.
That's amazing. Well, so yeah, we'll definitely have a link on the show page, but his name is Teo, T-E-O-H. His middle name is Y-I and his last name is C-H-I-E.
All right. Well, that is our show today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, the executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lichtai, Andy Bowers, the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page for more information, slate.com/XX. Facebook is facebook.com/XXGabFest to answer our questions. How are you going to protest? What's the right way to protest? And what is your crappy, shameful holiday movie that your family watches? Our Twitter is XXGabFest. You can also write to us there or email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes. Leave comments so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will be back in a couple of weeks.
Traffic jam.